This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm sitting in Nome, Alaska, and I'm joined on Skype by Mike Singer in Seattle and Travis Tinsey from Miami, Florida.
Hello.
Travis works for a company called Afric Air, and I'd been hearing about him for years when I was ferrying airplanes. Everyone I'd talked to at the company I worked with, Wings of Eagles, would tell me, man, you got to meet this guy Travis. He's a climber too, and he's living over in Miami working for Afric Air. And I usually kind of dismissed that because as a pilot, you'd hear about other climbers, and usually it didn't mean much. But one time I had a little layover in Miami, and Travis took me out to the climbing gym. And, well, that was pretty embarrassing for me. He kind of whooped my ass in a Miami climbing gym, which is thoroughly embarrassing. And as we started talking, we also realized we have a common acquaintance who's a climbing buddy of mine who lives in Detroit, who I climb with quite frequently. So since then, Travis and I have talked quite a bit. We even met up briefly in Chamonix, where we were both doing climbing on separate climbing trips. But today we're going to talk about his work at Afric Air and what Afric Air is about. Briefly, it's a company that sells airplanes and does a lot of business in Africa, as the name would imply. So Travis, and I don't even know this story, despite having spent time with you, when did you start flying and where did you start flying at?
I started my flying when I was 17 at a small airport in Cairo, Michigan, north of Detroit in the thumb of Michigan. So that was over a decade ago. And I guess it was my junior year of high school, and I took my first airplane ride, I think when I was 16, and it was something that I wanted to do. I'd always been somewhat of a space nerd and had gone to space camp and wanted to fly. So I took odd jobs at the airport. I cut grass at the Cairo airport. What else did I do? I washed airplanes. I used to hang out there every Saturday and just do odd jobs, from sweeping the floor of the hangar to getting greasy and taking apart airplanes and just learning about the ins and outs. A guy by the name of Eric Engler, who was the airport manager in Cairo, kind of took me under his wing, no pun intended, and he was an A&P mechanic, and in retrospect, he provided a lot of opportunity for me, but he also showed me a lot of good and bad things. So I'm sure we all have that person in our aviation career, and mm-hmm. He was it for me.
Cool. So you'd wanted to fly for a long time. It was kind of a coming together of a childhood dream type of deal.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it just fell in line with something adventurous that I wanted to do. And I never pictured myself as an airline pilot or anything like that. And I had never dreamed of that. I had never dreamed of going into the military as a pilot. I just saw all these little Cessnas at the airport, and I saw the tailwheel aircraft, and I said, man, that looks really cool. And I started flying there in a 172, got my private license, and after that, gentlemen at the airport would let me use their aircraft, so I flew all sorts of different airplanes, from Stinsons to Luscombs to a Citabria. I have a lot of time in a Citabria. I think this guy Eric showed me how to fly the Citabria, and I used to take crazy trips all over the state of Michigan, and I used to do things that I probably shouldn't have done, including aerobatics. Over the thumb, I used to dive bomb carp fishermen in the Saginaw Bay that were shooting carp with bows and arrows. Wow. With my little brother. I used to have a girlfriend in Ohio as well, and I used to fly down and see her. So that was the start of my aviation career, kind of just trying to stay alive in retrospect.
Yeah. So that was all before you were 18?
Yeah. 17, 18-ish. I think when I was 18, my cousin and I, we planned a kayaking / camping trip on Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And the plan was to load up this Citabria full of camping gear and fly to the UP. And we did it during a weekend when there was a low-pressure system sitting over the entire state of Michigan. And we had this plane loaded to the gills full of camping gear. And we took off from the Cairo airport with our moms watching, sisters. And, you know, I'm sure they were terrified. And I think our fathers were so nervous they chose not to even come out to the airport. I'm surprised they let us do it in retrospect. And we had climbing gear because Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore in the UP is a very picturesque, wild place on the shores of Lake Superior. So we flew all the way up there, and without getting into much detail, I think we were lucky not to have... I had a Loran GPS, and I got above the clouds at some point. I didn't have an instrument rating at the time. And I don't know, it was just young man mistakes, but we made it to the Upper Peninsula okay and unscathed, and we proceeded to do our little kayaking trip and had a great time. And that was the extent of my early flying career. There are many more stories, but that was it.
Wow.
That's a good way to start. So you were climbing back then too.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
Climbing for me was something early on, even before flying. So I had always dreamt of climbing big mountains as a kid. And my cousin Ricky and I, when we went up to climb on Pictured Rocks and kayak along Pictured Rocks, we took homemade harnesses made out of seat belts woven together on his mom's sewing machine. And we went to the local tractor supply company to buy nylon ropes. So they weren't even climbing ropes. When we were in these kayaks and we flew up there in the Citabria, it was a grass strip, bad weather. Fortunately, Lake Superior was dead calm, but it was really foggy. So we went out and found the biggest cliff we could find along Pictured Rocks and climbed to the top of it, found a tree, and then threw the rope over the side and took our seatbelt harnesses out and rappelled down the side of the cliff. Just for a fun activity to do. And we got to the bottom of the cliff and we pulled the rope. You know, we didn't even have real climbing carabiners. We had a bunch of tractor supply, hardware to use instead. And we pulled the rope and the rock there, I remember looking at the nylon rope and the rock had almost eaten all the way through the rope when we were rappelling, and we decided that it was a bad idea to do that again. So
the scud run up there might have been the safest part.
Yeah, I think that was the safest part, actually.
Did you at least use like really good fishing line for the threads on the harnesses, or just standard thread?
Standard thread. It was we just went over it, you know, a bunch on using his mom's sewing machine. Ricky made the harnesses. And we didn't even have like real leg loops. It was just the harness, like the belt. And I think I forgot how he rigged it exactly, but there are two ways to do things, I think. And one is to take the course and learn the proper way as you can. The other way is just to try it for yourself. And I think in many ways, climbing can be compared to flying. And in my early climbing and flying career, that I guess it kind of happened at the same time. I was in the category that just went out and tried it without, mm-hmm. you know, and I look at all the mistakes I've made climbing and flying. And I think without, you know, at some point you just have to look at the situation you're in and say, okay, is this safe? And you kind of just use common sense to get through it. And I think I'm really lucky to be alive in many cases, but you know, I guess that's how you learn. And it's not everyone's path, but it was my path, so it was fun.
Do you think the actually, two things. One is I've found that I think the flying and climbing, there's some decision making that's very similar, but at the same time, the brain space for me has always been very different. And I got back from one of my early ferry flights where they were still, I really had to think about what I was doing a lot, and I jumped on El Cap with a friend of mine, and I remember getting to the first anchor, and I was looking at four bolts, and I was trying to figure out how to set up an anchor. I mean, it's four bolts. It's like not hard to set up an anchor, but my brain just couldn't think through just how to smack in a couple carabiners and throw a cordelette on it. It was very strange for me to realize my head was still in flying and it wasn't in climbing yet. So the decision making is similar, but it was sometimes difficult for me to jump back and forth real quickly. I don't know why.
I guess it.
I could just be an idiot.
I don't think you are, Aiden. I think same climbing, same as flying. If you're not doing it on a regular basis, you tend to lose proficiency. So, in order to stay proficient at both, you have to do both on a regular basis. So I think maybe you were flying a lot, but to go jump on El Cap, that's a big undertaking. So.
But my friend Kate really knew what she was doing too. That didn't help. she had a different system for everything. So the second part of that question was, you got into tail draggers early on, and we actually have a lot of people kind of ask whether we think tail dragger an endorsement is useful or helpful. And do you think that's something that might have helped out your early flying, or is it a fun thing to do that didn't have a whole lot of effect on your overall flying?
For sure. The tailwheel time was invaluable. It was just really good to be able to learn how to fly all those different types of aircraft early on, from the Stinson to the Luscombe to the what else did I fly? A couple hours in a Cub, not a Super Cub, but just a Cub, and the Citabria. So grass strips, just bombing around and the Thumb of Michigan. It was a lot of fun. I compare it to trad climbing, actually. I had a buddy ask me once, so what's it like flying a tailwheel aircraft? And I said, well, it's like the difference between sport climbing and trad climbing. It's you really have to stay on the rudders and are on the rudder and feel the aircraft. And something romantic about flying an aircraft with a stick, you point it down and to the left and it goes down and to the left, or you pull it back into the right and it goes up into the right, and it's just really neat. Tandem seating.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
I'm with you. I like flying sticks, are just, they seem more intuitive than a yoke.
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
Cool. All right. I guess it's probably time to move on. I could go on about climbing for a long time, but,
yeah, same here.
So that takes you to like 18. Did you go to college anywhere, to aviation school, or just did you just kind of keep banging around?
No, I kept banging around. Before I graduated high school, I took a job flying for a crop duster in the state of Michigan, and I flew a Cessna 172. I got my commercial before I got my instrument rating. So I got my commercial certificate before the instrument rating. So that allowed me to take odd jobs in the state of Michigan. So I flew for this crop duster, and I would lay out the grid for him and also take local government officials like county clerks, etc., to observe his spray operations during a gypsy moth submission program in the state of Michigan. So one summer, or I think later in the fall, we were flying around northern Michigan spraying all of the forest because the gypsy moths are a really big, they're a big problem in northern Michigan, so he would spray the forest for that. And I would just take the officials up and make sure that he was spraying the forest, not the neighborhoods, because they were concerned about that for some reason. And then I got my instrument rating, I think my my sophomore year of college. My freshman year, I don't think I did much flying. We were just bombing around. And then I went to Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. For my first year, I really wasn't concerned about flying at all. When I did fly, I had a girlfriend in Ohio, and I used to fly down there on weekends on occasion. But I was just new to the college scene and wanted to live it up, so to speak. So yeah, have fun. I got a job at Munn Ice Arena in East Lansing, Michigan. It's where the Spartans play hockey, and I started driving the Zamboni. So I did that for 4 years in college.
You have no idea how many people envy you for that. especially little kids.
Man, it was a lot of fun. Yeah. So flying kind of took a back seat, actually, and until my sophomore year when I decided to get my instrument rating. And I remember riding my bike from my house to class in the morning. Then I would, after class, I'd ride to the local airport where this guy let me borrow his plane, Eric Engler from Caro, to I'd pay him for fuel to get my instrument rating. And I'd fly from Mason Airport, south of East Lansing, to Pontiac to do my flight training with this instructor there at II. And I did it in like 2 months while I was taking classes at Michigan State. And then I would fly back to East Lansing, ride my bike back to the ice rink, and I'd close the ice rink late at night. I'd work till like 2 in the morning. And there was like figure skating going on and a club hockey team. And I remember we call it making ice. And I'd make ice late, shut the place down, work for, you know, 2.5-3 hours at night, and then do it all over again the next day. So it was a busy time my sophomore year of college. And I didn't go to an aviation school. I graduated Michigan State with a degree in economics and finance because all along, I never really planned to be a pilot. I just wanted to use it on the side, or it seemed like a means to adventure, you know. So I just wanted to continue with my ratings and stuff like that. And I studied on my own. As a matter of fact, during the instrument rating, during the oral, I remember, you know, I think the examiner was just very nice because I shouldn't have passed the oral. Because I was more concerned about studying for my college classes than the instrument oral exam. Fortunately, I think I flew pretty good on the check ride, so I got my instrument rating, and I was pretty psyched about that. And then my junior and senior year of college, I used to fly right seat for a couple companies based out of MBS International Airport, Midland Bay City Saginaw International Airport in the Thumb. Once again, flying for this guy, Eric. I've got time in a Cheyenne 2, a Cessna 340, and a G100 or an Astrojet 1125. So that was actually my first job out of college.
So you had got a lot of kind of sort of random opportunities just through the connections you made back in high school.
Yeah, exactly. I did. And this, they allowed me to fly all over the place, all over the state of Michigan. And in college, you know, I'd make an invoice out just for flying right seat in a 340. And I had all the appropriate ratings at the time, so I could charge people for my services. But I remember at the time I'd like make out an invoice for $200 for sitting in the right seat, and I thought it was big money back then, you know, being in college. I was 3-4 and making next to nothing driving a Zamboni, but it was fun. That was a special time.
Hell, that's still big money in my world. That's sad. So I'm just curious because you never really were thinking about making flying a career. And I know you've flown kind of all over the world now. You've flown South America, Africa, a little bit in Alaska. I mean, how did you end up at AfricAir? I mean, how did you end up?
Well,
how did your path lead you to Miami at AfricAir? Yeah.
The story goes on. In my mind, I just kind of seek adventure. So flying was always a means to adventure. That's kind of the way I see it. And so I graduated from college with a degree in economics and finance, and I remember tossing my resume around to a bunch of different places, and my heart was set on going to Alaska. I applied at a place outside of Juneau, and that I guess was notorious for hiring rookie pilots with their credentials, but I guess it was really dangerous flying. But I didn't care, you know. I just wanted to get out and go have an adventure, you know. I was in Michigan. I just wanted to get out and see the world. And I applied at this place, and the guy wanted to hire me. And I was all set to go, and my heart was set on going to Alaska. And I ran it by my parents, and my parents said, "Hell no, you're not going to Alaska."
They finally got smart.
My mom, well, the thing about parents is that they always adapt. And my parents are the greatest. They're really cool. And, you know, they provided words of wisdom at a crucial time, I think. And my father was like, "Hey, Travis, you know, I understand you want to do this, but, you know, they helped me out, paying for a lot of college and, just for me to run off and go do my thing, you know. I felt like I needed to, I don't know, help them out as well and get like a stable job after college. So I was also offered a job flying right seat for a company called Duralast Roofing in their Astrojet. Now it's the G-100 flying for this guy again. And I had a long sit-down conversation with my dad, and he's like, "Travis, you got to take this job. You know, you'd be stupid not to take the job. They're offering you three times the amount of pay that you'd make in Alaska. You know, they offered to pay for my type rating on the jet. You know, you'd be stupid not to take it." And I did it. And I had just over 1,000 hours at the time, I think, or like 1,200 hours. And they hired me for the right seat. So I don't know how legal that was, but I went to flight safety. I think when I was 21 or 22 years old. Yeah, 22 years old. Mm. And I remember being there with a bunch of old senior pilots, and I was the rookie, and I felt really out of place. But it went well, and I learned a lot, and I studied hard. And anyways, I took that job and flew for Duralast Roofing. And I did that for 2 years out of college. I lived in Bay City, Michigan, and it was a really fun time.
That's just, it just ties into a lot of things I just keep hearing from people. People tend to think they don't have enough time to get jobs. And everyone, when they're learning how to fly, they're so focused on ratings, they don't really start building connections. And I'm just seeing more and more, the more people I talk to, that, well, even before you start your first lesson, if you can go to an airport and start working, start meeting people, you never know where these connections lead you down the road. I mean, that's a cool opportunity for, you know, someone with 1,000 hours.
Yeah, it was. And what we did at Duralast, we'd fly this Astrojet around and pick up contractors all over the U.S. It was a roofing company, Duralast Roofing. They manufactured like a pool liner that went on a roof. It was a plastic roof. So we'd pick up contractors all over the country and then fly them back to Saginaw, Michigan to tour the plant, the facility, and then fly them back. So we flew all over the place, and it was a great opportunity for me to build hours, get some jet time, and I was really lucky. So I did that for 2 years. I graduated college in 2007, and then 2009 rolled around, and that's kind of when the U.S. economy was not in the greatest shape. So Duralast decided to sell their jet. So I kind of actually welcomed the opportunity, they offered me a position to stay working at Duralast, like answering phone calls and getting into the roofing industry. And I didn't take it. I was like, no, I want to get out. And so finally, the opportunity came for me to go to Alaska. And I looked all over the place, and the only job I could see was working for a lodge as like an adventure guide. It was 90 miles northwest of Anchorage within the Wild Adventure Lodges, and they had, I think, three or four lodges. Now they're much larger. So I went up there for 3 months, and I took odd flying jobs that I could find on Craigslist, but mostly I was just a guide for this adventure.
You found flying jobs on Craigslist? I've never thought about that. I don't know why not.
Yeah. I a couple jobs flying a 206. I think one was for elk meat, and out of the Lake Hood Airport there on the little grass strip. So that was kind of neat. And
but I'm going to go on Craigslist.
At this lodge, yeah. So it was a lot of fun guiding tourists around, and people would go to the lodge from all over the place, and I kind of doubled as a climbing guide, so that was fun. And then the end of the summer rolled around, and I hadn't done a lot of flying, and I wanted to get my float rating. So I went to get my float rating out of Lake Hood with this lady named Heidi. Have you heard of her, Aiden? Heidi, are you there?
I'm actually thinking was it her and her husband running a flight school?
Yes. I never met her husband, but Heidi, I can't think of her last name.
Yeah, but, I think the helicopter driver I just interviewed for Bering Air, Corey,
uh-huh.
I think he did his ratings with them.
Yeah, it was her. I'd have to go back and look at my logbook, but I flew with her for 2 hours, I think. But in the meantime, I was planning a climbing trip in the Canadian Rockies with my buddy Garrett. And
yes.
All along, I had planned to meet him at a certain date in, I think it was late September or early October. I can't really remember. So I ended up bailing.
That wasn't Cirque of the Unclimbables, was it?
No, it was Mount Robson area up in
Yep.
Yeah, so anyways, I basically took what little money I had left, and because I blew it all like trying to get my rating or my float rating and buying climbing gear that I didn't have, and I bailed on the float rating after 2 hours, and thought it was more important to get to the Canadian Rockies. So I found another lady on Craigslist who needed a truck transported from Anchorage to Seattle. So I drove her truck all the way from Anchorage to Seattle, and then she bought my plane ticket from Seattle to the Canadian Rockies, where I met up with my buddy, and did some climbing with him for a couple weeks, and then we had a little bit of an accident, or he did rather, an emergency situation, and we drove all the way back to Michigan. And then also while all of this was happening, I was entertaining the idea of going to Africa to fly. So I had sent a couple emails back and forth to a guy by the name of Pat Patton, who started Flying Medical Service in East Africa back in the 80s. And I actually met Pat in Michigan before I left to go to Alaska for the summer. I think I was looking at bush flying jobs all over the world before I went to Alaska, and that's how I ran into Pat online. So I sent Pat an email even before I went to Alaska, and Pat responded and said, "Hey, I'm from Michigan, blah blah blah. This is where I'll be, and I'll be in Michigan next month." And this is again before I went to Alaska. So I called him, and we met in Port Austin, Michigan, because his family had a cottage less than 10 miles from where my family has a cottage on the shores of Lake Huron. And he told me all of these flying stories about flying in East Africa. And at the time, they just sounded just wild, you know, flying in East Africa, doing remote clinics in the bush, over the Rift Valley and active volcanoes and zebras and elephants and giraffe, just wild stories. And I couldn't even wrap my head around it at the time, so I shipped off to Alaska and did that. And then I came back, and the whole time I was in Alaska, I was thinking about going to Africa. And before I got back to Michigan after that little climbing excursion after Alaska, I called my parents once again and said, "Hey, Mom and Dad, I'm thinking about going to Africa." And I just heard crickets on the other end of the phone. Like, really, Travis? And the first thing they said is, "Well, your grandparents aren't getting any younger, blah blah blah," and the guilt trip route. But as I mentioned before about my parents, they always adapt. So I got back to Michigan after the climbing thing and went to Africa to fly for Flying Medical Service as a volunteer pilot. I think in October. And never been to Africa before. Went to Arusha, Tanzania, and they operated two Cessna 206 aircraft. And man, that was an eye-opening experience. And we did routine weekly clinics into the African bush, and gave vaccinations, and we kind of ran the maternal clinics for the Maasai, people that didn't have access to normal health care. And Pat Patton was just, continues to be instrumental in that part of the world in providing health care for next to nothing to people that desperately need it. And I fell in love with Africa then, and it was spectacular.
So it's Flying Medical Service, that's what it's called?
Yep, Flying Medical Service.
And I think I'm going to talk to either you or your buddies who are coming here up to Alaska about this later on, so I'm not going to go too in-depth. But it actually sounds like a place that I ended up at AirServe, but I think I would have preferred something like this. Mm. He's just providing, Pat Patterson's just providing the aircraft for it? Is he providing the actual doctors and the medical personnel as well?
It's the whole shebang. He provides the doctors, the medical supplies, the pilots, and the pilots actually run the clinics. So I found myself showing medical students from the U.S. and from Europe how to give babies vaccinations. So, they're the ones that are the med students, and I'm the idiot pilot over there from the States, and I just take the needle and stick it in the baby's leg, and they start crying, and the med students, were like, "Oh, that's how it's done." So I kind of act like I knew what I was doing when really I didn't have the slightest clue.
I'm gonna ask you more about this right now. I'd actually pulled them up online while we were talking. It's a volunteer thing. So are pilots volunteer, or is there some sort of stipend, or do you need to provide all your own means of survival? Or is it changed depending on who you are and what you're doing for?
Pilots volunteer. Maybe it's changed, but I think at the time it was like between $2,000 and $3,000 a year, which was just enough to kind of get by. You're completely on your own. You're a volunteer, but they do provide housing. They've got vehicles there. They've got dirt bikes. And I just commuted back and forth to the airport on a dirt bike. And, for Africa, that's all you need. When you're a young person and looking for some adventure, and, that's all you need. And
I don't even think you need to be a young person.
No, exactly. I think when I was there, there was this guy named PJ, and PJ was an ex-helicopter pilot for the Marines, and now he lives in Alaska, so he'd be another good person to interview. But he stayed there for 3 years, which is,
long time.
A long time, and Ezra was there for 9 years, so they're the guys to talk to, because I just had a short stint initially for those guys. But, if you've got a big heart, you want to give back to the community, those guys are a group of the nicest people that you will ever run across anywhere. And Pat Patton is just a spectacular person. And to this day, he continues to fly his 206 aircraft over there and provide these medical services for people that wouldn't have access to it otherwise. So after a while, I left because I was offered a job in Miami to fly a jet, a G-100, and it was a lot of money, and it was something that I really couldn't turn down, and I had a really hard time with it at the time, because I was like, man, I love it over here, I don't really want to leave Africa, but I was still a volunteer pilot, I still had a ton of college debt, and I did feel a lot of pressure from my parents, and to make some money, So that's why I left.
But you gotta move it. You can't work for free forever.
Yeah, exactly.
No matter how cool it is and how much. I mean, I'll try to get in touch with Pat. Mm-hmm. Pat, that looks actually awesome.
So I have a question. As you were doing sort of all these jobs, both in college and afterward here, were you thinking at all about building time or building specific kinds of experience because you wanted to get a specific kind of job eventually and have a specific kind of career? Or it sounds like you were more just focusing, as you said, on adventure, and that by doing that, those opportunities would arise and you take them, and as a result, your logbook would end up being whatever it is, and that would just lead to the next adventure.
Yeah, it was definitely the latter. I think I talked to a lot of pilots, and even when I was doing this, Michigan State is not an aviation school, and I had a lot of friends go to Western Michigan, which is a really good aviation school, and they did the standard route, paid a lot of money, and became flight instructors and did that. Fortunately, I never had to go that route. I never got my flight instructor's rating, but I just wanted adventure, and I was actively seeking adventure, and I was willing to go anywhere and live as a dirtbag, whatever it took, anywhere in the world. And flying was just a means, If you look hard enough, someone will always hire you, I think. But you have to be willing to go anywhere. And, I didn't have a girlfriend. I was, I just wanted to see it all. I wanted to do it all and climb everything. And in many ways, I'm still at that. I still feel that way. But I think if pilots, a lot of young pilots, old pilots, whatever, if they kind of broke away from the mold of the standard way to obtain flight hours, and they thought about something a little bit off the beaten path, if they went into uncharted waters, exactly what Oddball Pilot's all about, if they just looked at a little harder, I think they'd find what they're looking for.
Yeah, there's a lot more out there than what the standard path shows you, and I think going back to the pilots who go to the more standard flight schools, something that we're seeing talking to people is they come out so in debt that they're kind of, they feel like they have to go the standard path. They mm-hmm. need to get to that airline job so they can justify spending this much money. And if you can do it as more pay-as-you-go basis, like when you were getting your ratings, you might have more opportunities, but you don't have to be, you're not paying off this debt every month. So that may be another thing for people to think about when they think about whether to go to a larger flight school or try to do it at a smaller flight school and save some money.
Yeah, I think so. And I agree with that 100%. And the people that I've met in the industry that fly the larger equipment, the bigger jets, some of the guys you run across at flight safety, some of those guys are just miserable. And they're always away from home, and they've kind of set themselves up to live a life that they seem to despise. And I think for me to see a lot of these guys early on it just turned me off to a flying career as an airline pilot or something like that. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are a lot of guys out there that love what they do, and they, but there are also a lot of guys that are that just seem miserable. And you know,
yeah, every pilot I you think talk, you're right.
They sit to a next to a guy in the cockpit at some point during their career, and they just can't stand the guy.
I think my FO can't stand me right now.
So I think that had a lot to do with me, you know, taking my current position in aircraft sales, because I didn't want that to be my primary outlet or my primary function.
Yeah. And actually, that's what we'll get back on track here. Was, it seems like flying as a volunteer for medical service in Tanzania is a far cry from selling airplanes out of Miami.
Yeah, so that was just pure luck. So I left Africa to take a job based out of Miami, flying a G-100 Astra jet, or 1125 Astra, now it's the G-100, for a Venezuelan businessman who owned a bunch of offshore oil rigs and lived in Miami, and he had owned a bunch of boats as well, like big ships, basically.
So he's like the antithesis to Pat Patton.
Yeah, it really was. And you know, I struggled with it for a long time because I felt like a sellout. Leaving Africa, leaving this great position, leaving all these good people for basically the money and the job and the, you know, the glory of, you know, a real, in retrospect, it was the right decision, but it was a really difficult decision for me. And then, so I flew with these Venezuelans, out of Miami for, I don't know, 2 to 3 months, after I left East Africa. And I think I spent less than a week total in Miami that whole time. I was always in Caracas, Venezuela, Cumana, Maracaibo, flying nearly every day, and I hated every second of it. I mean, I was making really good money, and I couldn't stand the guy I was flying with. He was miserable, one of those guys, and I just didn't like it. You know, any longer, I think I would have went to Alaska or back to Africa, until I ran into a pilot for Africair at the Tamiami Airport one day, and he gave me his card. He said he was looking for a guy to fly right seat in their CJ3 on occasion, and I took his card and I called him, and next thing I know, I found myself working as a contract pilot for Africair, flying right seat in their CJ3, and I quit working for the Venezuelans because I couldn't stand it. And I really didn't know what I was going to do at that point. This was 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago. And I didn't know what I was going to do, so I just stayed flying with Africair, and they offered me a full-time position as a pilot. And now Africair were the authorized Cessna aircraft distributors for Africa. And we also represent Bell Helicopter. We represent EasyGo Golf Cars, amongst other things. We represent Thrush Spray Planes. And now we sell Polaris off-road vehicles in a lot of African countries as well. So we do all these things, but the bread and butter is Cessna and Bell Helicopter sales. So as a pilot for Africair, I was a demo pilot. And we would, early on, I think my first tour was flying our Citation Mustang from Miami through the Caribbean islands to Suriname in South America. And I know it's not Africair, but we also have a sister company called Tropical Aviation Distributors. So I went with our sales guy at the time, John Price, who's still with the company. He's a vice president for Africair. And So it was me and the other pilot and John Price, and we flew down to Suriname. And the sales guys kind of run the show, and they conduct the whole demo tour. So we were basically just showing this new Citation Mustang to our customers in the region. And we spent a couple weeks in the islands, and then like one week in Suriname, and then flew it home. And I was hooked. I couldn't wait for my first Africa tour. And then that summer rolled around, I think. I don't even remember when it was. But we were going to fly the Mustang to Africa. So we flew it across the North Atlantic, the other pilot and myself. And we toured in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and left the Mustang in France. And then we went back to the States. And then over the course of the next year and a half, we took the Mustang all over Africa. We went to East Africa, South Africa, West Africa. I think I hit maybe like 16 different countries. And it was myself and the other pilot the whole time. And, you know, the people you meet, you know, it's outstanding. It was really fun, and I fell in love
massive
with Africa.
Exposure.
Yeah, I fell in love with Africa more and more, and we'd work directly with different Africair salesmen, and I looked at their interaction with our customers in Africa, and all along I kind of thought, hey man, that'd be a really cool thing to do, because I just look at the relationships they have, and it's really neat, you know. They're providing, they're genuine friends with the customers there, and they help facilitate their business, whether it be safari companies, charter operators, private individuals, and it's really neat. So
let me just so these tours you were on, you were the demo pilot. So did you have a sales team in the back of the plane, or is it you and you were flying right seat at this point?
Yeah, I was flying right seat in the Mustang. I would you know, I didn't know anything about flying internationally, really. I mean, because for flying medical service it was just locally, but you know, that's a whole new world when you're flying from one country to the next and over the North Atlantic. So before Africa, I didn't know anything about landing permits and overflight permits and coordinating with the locals to land and how to file a flight plan, stuff like that. So during this time, I learned all of that, and I would line up these tours and I'd follow the flight plans and do everything. Basically, it was the other pilot and myself, but we'd trade off flying in the left seat and do these tours, but we would have a sales team in the back. And by sales team, it's just one guy.
Right.
Africa, we break it down per sales guy. So we have four sales guys covering Africa at the moment, and each of us has a separate territory.
Like your own niche, either is geographically or aircraft type?
Geographically. In East Africa... Well, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but at the time, so we'd coordinate with each salesperson geographically, and then they'd set up the whole demo tour, who'd they want to see the aircraft, and we as pilots would just comply, you know. And
so you'd get the overflight permits, the landing permissions, file the flight plans. Your job at that point was really to deal with the flying side of the business, and the salespeople were dealing with the sales side.
Yep, you got it. So that's cool.
And now you've moved more into the sales side of things.
Yes. So about a year ago, I went to the owner and CEO of Africair, and I said, "Hey, look, you know, a while ago you and I had talked about a sales position, and you know, I said, hey, I think I'd really like to do that, and it just so happened that." It was just a timing thing, and he's like, yeah, Travis, you know, well, why don't you start by working with John Price, who I have a really good relationship with, and John Price has been with Africair now for over 20 years, and his territory is East Africa, so the five countries that make up the East African Union, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi, and Zambia. So that's his territory. And he's like, why don't you work under John Price and start selling single-engine piston aircraft? And that was my in, and that's what I do to this day. And it's been really, really fun. And I make a lot of mistakes, but I try to learn from each mistake. And selling aircraft is a different ball game entirely. And having flown aircraft, it really helps on the sales side of thing, because, you know, how do you know what you're talking about if you haven't really flown the aircraft? So it really helps me having the experience of flying the machines, and it translates into selling them as well.
Well, and yeah, but when you look at their operation and you know what type of plane they need, but companies, aircraft manufacturing companies, will put out certain information about a plane, but you, if you actually know how to fly them, you can say, well, yeah, it doesn't, it does do all that, but this other plane does it a little bit better. And it gives you more insight, I would think, into what might be more appropriate for a company.
Yeah, it really does. I'm a little biased towards Cessna aircraft, but
Cessnas are awesome.
That they are. But it, man, it's
flying a Spanish plane right now, I can tell you Cessnas are awesome.
So, just learning about the logistics of how to sell aircraft or how to source aircraft, they take them to Africa. You know, there are hundreds of steps that need to happen for the aircraft to successfully get to Africa. I'm still learning, and there's so much that I don't know. So I lean heavily on guys within the company that have a ton of experience selling aircraft in Africa. John Price is one of them. But working with the customers is the most valuable part about my job, I think, is everyone's unique and everyone has a different mission requirement.
Well, I think people, when they first hear aircraft salesman, they're going to oversimplify it. And they think used car salesman, they just think you're out there pushing a product. And even just talking to you a couple of weeks ago, it's much more than that. Because these are long-term relationships you're creating with your clients. So you don't want to sell them a product that's not good for them. And you also have to keep track of the political and kind of economic interests in those countries and what international grants or the international monetary situation might be, what the exchange rate might be with the company. There's a lot more to it than just trying to push a new airplane, a new product.
Yeah, that's true. We have to – each of the sales guys at Africare are more or less experts at their geographical region. And we have to know what's going on with the political environment. I've given presentations to the Ugandan Air Force, for example, and you know, they've got a requirement for training aircraft, and they want to know what would be the best training aircraft for them. So in that part of the world, avgas is very scarce. So Africare has a diesel retrofit for a 172, and then Cessna is coming out with a new JTA 182, hopefully later this year. So I think both of those aircraft will allow me to have a good base or a good platform to kind of kick the sales thing off right. You know, I've sold maybe a half a dozen aircraft, but the biggest thing that I sell is the 206, the Cessna 206. John Price deals with all the caravans and jets going up. I help him on occasion with caravans, but I've had a couple 206 go to East Africa in the last couple months. And you're right, being a sales guy, you have to not only fly the aircraft and coordinate what happens on this part of the ocean, but working with the governments in East Africa or anywhere else, you have to kind of know what their budget requirements are, who's doing the funding, and there's so many different steps involved with, you know, closing on the deal, so to speak. one thing that I'm actively in. Go ahead.
Oh, and you really are trying to sell them a product they're going to be happy with 10 years from now. You're not, again, ongoing relationships. It's not that quick sale. It's much more, you know, it might take you a year or 2 years to set up a sale for in these 180Ds, diesel 182s you're talking about. I know you've been working on that for quite a while. But
yeah.
Yeah, it just, it always, the more I've talked to you, just the more involved and the cooler it sounds the job.
Yeah, the marketing for the 183 has been going on for about, just a year now. And the aircraft is, we can't wait for one to arrive. And it will eventually, and that'll be great. And I plan on doing a big demo tour in East Africa. Hopefully Aiden can come along on that one. But
that would be awesome.
I guess to slow it down a little bit, one thing I'm working on now is using one of these aircraft for a surveillance platform for a lot of the safari lodge operators and the game parks, the reserves, the national parks in East Africa, because that's their number one source of tourism in East Africa and in all of Africa, really. And people come from all over the world to see these great places, these great habitats, that, and elephants and rhinos and zebras and everything that makes up Africa. And if they can't protect that resource, then they really don't have a leg to stand on. So I'm working on providing an efficient and economical solution and a surveillance platform using, you know, our aircraft for a lot of these different places. And you have to figure out how each organization functions. You have to figure out where they get their funding from, if it's a private donor-based organization, if it's a big international conglomerate, basically, that provides them funding. And then you have to go to the donors and say, hey, look, this is what we think would be a good solution for our poaching problem or our, you know, preservation issue. So, and you have to not only sell it to the game park wardens, but you have to show the donors that this is the solution. And like you said, you know, it's not a used car thing. It's not even close to that, because it doesn't do us any good to provide these people with something they don't need and won't last them well into the future, because Africare, we plan on being around for a long time. We've been in Africa for 45 years, and if we get them into an aircraft that doesn't fit their mission requirements, then we're doing ourselves a huge disservice.
Yeah, you lose credibility.
Yeah.
It's almost like you're doing what you went to school to do, but got there through aviation.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well,
I'm really pleased. I love Africare. It's a great company, and I'm really finding my stride here. There's so much to do. You know, I've got enough on my plate now to keep me busy for forever. And as long as they're happy with me, which I hope they are, you know, I love coming in on weekends. I am so involved with every little bit of my position here at Africare, whether it be on the flying side, the sales side, helping out our customers in East Africa. But the charter operators, it's a great thing. I love working with them. The safari lodge operators, that's awesome. The governments, it's way cool. Giving presentations to the Ugandan Air Force and the Zambian Air Force and the Kenyan military, Ministry of Defense. You know, it's really neat.
The on a more practical side, so your day-to-day life, I mean, how much time do you spend in Miami in the office, and how much time do you spend out of the office on tours, sort of on a yearly basis, just a rough guesstimate percentage-wise?
I would say 8 months out of the year in Miami, 4 months out of the year in Africa.
It's sort of a good – it's a mix of sort of travel, adventure, but then you also get to be home a fair amount and have a decent somewhat stable life.
Yes. I think my girlfriend would disagree. But a lot of the reason why I kind of wanted to move out of flying and into sales. It's because I didn't like being at someone else's mercy 24/7, basically. Hey, we got to fly. We got a flight. You know, we got to go. And I didn't like that.
Yeah, I hear you.
There's still some of that on the sales side of things, but now I kind of get to pick and choose when I travel and how I travel, and it's nice. So I don't think I spend a lot of time out of the office still and away from home, you know, months at a time, but at least it's at my own schedule or on my own schedule.
Yeah, that's what I've always said. It's fine being away as long as you kind of it's your own plan. My FOs heard me bitch about that this shift. That's a long story. The other question is, and you don't have to go into number specifics, but in terms of pay, are you on a commission or is it a salary plus commission? Is it all commission, all salary?
It's salary and commission on top of that. So
it's a mix.
Yeah, it's definitely a mix, but if the commission wasn't there, then, well, let me
It'd
put it this way.
It'd be a tough living.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, you're right about that. But what I put into my job is directly correlated to what I get out of it. So, and that's what I really enjoy about the job is that if you're a motivated person, if you are willing to just put your head down and really get involved with what's happening over there or with the sales process, I'd like to think you'd get rewarded eventually. I've yet to, you know, close that huge government contract. I think, you know, at least I'm taking the steps towards, you know, doing that someday.
Getting there.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. You know, I've really enjoyed the process thus far. And for the aircraft that I have sold, and starting the relationships with, you know, my customers in East Africa, it's been really fun. And I have a genuine interest in what they want to accomplish flying the aircraft that I provide. And I want to make sure that it's exactly what they need and exactly what they want. So that's really rewarding for me on this side.
How much input do you think you have with Cessna being one of the bigger customers? When you go and talk to your customers in East Africa, do you think the folks at Cessna listen to you when you come back and say, hey, they're looking for this? Do you think you have any, probably not a lot of input, but influence on what Cessna might look for in their next aircraft they're building?
Yeah. One of the things I get asked a lot in East Africa is, hey, you've got a, well, our customers say, hey, you've got a diesel 182. That's great. But when are you going to come out with a diesel 206?
Yep.
And I think if I had a diesel 206, man, that'd be great. And I think Cessna knows that. But as a distributor, I think we have some influence. You know, we can relay, you know, what the field is looking like basically to the engineers or the people that make these decisions.
Yep.
But I think it's really small influence.
Okay, but they must do market research. So you come and say, boy, they really want a diesel 206. And they probably do some research, say, okay, we'll sell 30 diesel 206 at East Africa. Is that worth retooling a whole production line? And my guess is with a diesel too, the 182 is just cheaper to do a prototype. And so they probably start with the 182 and then they'll see if that really works, then we'll move on and try a bigger plane. But
yeah, that could be the thought process at Cessna.
You probably have a better feel for the thought process than I do.
Yeah. You know, what's
big,
about
big
being
company stuff.
The Cessna distributor for Africa is that, you know, Africa Air has been the distributor for 45 years. So we've got these long-lasting relationships with the clientele across the continent. And, you know, for other distributors in other parts of the world, you know, we've got these relationships. And I guess our customers think differently than customers in the States, or in South America or in Europe. So I really hope that Cessna listens to what some of the feedback that we provide them about what our customers need. And I think for the most part, Cessna does a good job coming out with great new products. The JTA will be the first mass production diesel aircraft, and it's a Cessna, so it's a proven airframe.
And the company will back it. So if there are issues, you know Cessna's going to work on it. They're going to work with the companies on fixing those issues.
Yeah, that's correct. Cessna's got great customer support, and we're part of that whole chain. And I'm really excited to see this whole program launch and you know, develop.
Yeah, that'll be cool. Another question then, and I think we're probably getting close to wrapping up. If a pilot wanted to get into an aircraft sales position, more specifically Africa Air, do you guys have openings, and what would be the best path to get in to a company like Africa Air? Is it through being a demo pilot? Is it through working for another sales company? You know, what's kind of just your rough feeling on what? I don't imagine you have a whole lot of turnover, but if somebody was interested, what would be their best path to your position? And I realize it's just your kind of take on it. Obviously there. I mean, there's not a structured path there.
I think.
What do you feel like Africa Air is looking for in a salesperson? I guess would be another way to rephrase that.
Right. Experience is a big thing, I think, but just willingness to go out there and kind of be self-sustaining and self-motivating. And I think if you're a person looking for structure, this is not the job for you. I think a lot of pilots like to know that, or that they feel a sense of fulfillment when they complete the mission, when they get the aircraft from point A to point B. And aircraft sales is not at all like being a pilot in that regard. Spend a lot of time like a farmer or like a miner, mining, looking for gold, you know, tending to your crops and hoping that one day you'll get a great harvest. And that's a lot
right.
Of sales. There's so many different outlets, and every customer has different requirements. So my advice to anyone looking into a position like this would be to be flexible. And, you know, you have to embark on a path that allows you to kind of be ready for anything. And I know that's not ideal for a lot of people, but the only reason I'm
interesting
in this position is that I was lucky, for one, to kind of end up in the same place that a company like Africa Air is based. But, you know, I kind of had the background, too, to be of service to them and provide value added and, you know, hopefully sell airplanes. So it's I should be doing that right now, actually.
Well, we'll let you get back to that. But I will say that I don't think it was luck. I've talked to a lot of pilots now, and everybody says, well, I got here, it was just luck. But after listening to almost everyone's story, everybody creates their own luck. I mean, you're there because you set up a situation where you were interesting to Africa Air, where you were someone they'd want to hire. So,
I don't know how many other organizations worldwide there are like Africa Air, but you know, there are other distributors. I think there's a distributor for Alaska, and you know, like being a pilot, I think it's pretty cutthroat, the sales industry. You know, people are really going to hold on to what they have and their customer base, and I'm finding that, you know, they should be very protective of what they have, because Everyone's replaceable, always. And, you know, when it comes to sales, you know, relationships are in place for a reason, but people always change too. So with sales, you always have to stay on it. And that's another thing that's not like being a pilot. You know, at the end of the day, if you're a pilot, you could just, you know, have the weekend yourself. But being an aircraft salesman now, I find that I need to always answer the phone or, you know, get back to people in a timely manner. And that's difficult for a lot of people and a lot of pilots. So,
oh, yeah. It's not, and you're also on Africa time, because they're going to try to call you during African business hours, not U.S. business hours.
Yeah, I find myself waking up really early just so I can correspond with Africa, and that's not fun. You know, every job has its you know, job portion. So, but
yeah, getting up at 3 a.m. is part of your job portion.
Yeah, it really is. And
but you get to go to the climbing gym frequently.
Yeah, it's really nice. You know, you asked what's it like being in the office versus Africa, and really they're worlds apart. So for a good portion of the year, I'm here in a nice air-conditioned office, and you're corresponding with Africa using your computer, and you've got your email here. But when I go to Africa, it's using my phone to call people from the back of a cab in Nairobi, and you've got the window down because the AC in the cab doesn't work, and there's a truck next to you spewing out toxic fumes into your cab, and you can't hear the guy on the other end of the line because he's got a really weird South African accent. And you know, that's running around Africa, and that's another part of the job that I really enjoy, but that's not for everybody.
Yeah, I was gonna say that a lot of times the parts of the job that are really interesting, this is with most flying jobs, or when things go wrong, it gets interesting. That doesn't always mean it's good. Probably the hard parts of jobs are what make those jobs interesting, but you try to avoid the hard parts if you can.
Yeah, that's true.
But that's what else? Another thing that we came up with a few months ago, the idea, there's certain experiences that the only way you're going to have them is to do jobs that might have parts that you don't like. But if you want to have those certain experiences, you have to do the job as a whole. It may take a while for those experiences to actually come about. They just don't happen every day. And sometimes that's worth it, sometimes it isn't. So,
yeah, as my father says, every job has its job characteristics. You know, there's still the grind of the job.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Cool.
I think one of these days it'd be cool to do an interview with talking about the job in East Africa and mm-hmm. Africa specifics.
Definitely.
Oh, absolutely. That's one. If you get this tour in East Africa, I want to come along. That's one thing I want to do, is kind of document what this job is, as well as talking to the East African operators and what they're looking for in pilots. So hopefully that'll happen. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I'd really like to do that. We'll take a couple GoPros with us as well and strap it to the wing.
Absolutely, and then we'll have to plan a climbing trip while we're down there.
I've got everything picked out for us, Aiden. There's Hell's Gate, Mount Kenya. I've got a really long tick list for East Africa, so it's there.
Fantastic. You lead the crux pitches, and I'll hump the packs around.
All right, man. Well, sounds good.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. This was a great talk, and I think people will find your story really inspiring and helpful.
All right. Well, cool, Mike. Thanks again, guys.
All right.
Cool. Yeah, Travis, thanks for taking the time. And it's Mike, Travis, and Aiden, Rodball Pilot. Over and out.
See ya.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.